Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents For No Reason at All, The Changing Narrative of the First World War in American Film, by Jeffrey A. Hinkleman, narrated by David DeVries. Introduction. In early December 2009, a West Virginia farmer testified before a congressional committee on behalf of a public memorial. In and of itself, that fact would be of no particular note, but this was not an ordinary farmer. Frank Buckles was 109 years old and the last remaining American veteran of the First World War. At 16, he had talked his way into the U.S. Army after being rejected by the Marines and the Navy and driven ambulances in France. As the last doughboy, Buckles had come to Congress to support legislation to commemorate that conflict. The proposal was simple. Though the National Mall was officially closed to further development, a small memorial to veterans from the Washington, D.C. area already existed. The rededication of that space to the memory of all who served in the Great War would allow the conflict to be acknowledged in the heart of the nation's capital without requiring new construction. What seemed like a sensible proposal was quickly challenged, however, from multiple directions. Representatives of the District of Columbia complained that the plan shortchanged local interests by intruding on a site dedicated to hometown veterans. The congressional delegation from Missouri wanted to protect the primacy of their own site in Kansas City, already home to the National World War I Museum and Memorial. In the end, Buckles's testimony was not enough to overcome these challenges, so the plan fell to political infighting. The failure of Buckles's plea, despite the late-in-life celebrity that made him a desirable spokesperson, reflects the national failure to recognize the importance of what is arguably the central event of the 20th century. Millions of people lost their lives in the carnage of the First World War, carnage that involved the destruction of empires, the creation of new nations, and the decimation of an entire generation. But how do we remember it? Buckles, who died in 2011 at the age of 110, was the last American who could claim to remember the war as a military veteran. But his celebrity derived more from his longevity than any burning public desire to think about the consequences of one of the most terrible conflicts in human history. The centennial of the First World War, observed much more attentively in Europe, occasioned only minor interest in the United States, and the observances that did take place stood in striking contrast to the activities and publicity that surrounded the 75th anniversary of the World War II Allies' invasion of Normandy. But that disparity suggests an answer to the question of how the Great War has come to be so marginalized in U.S. history. The First World War has been utterly overshadowed by its sequel. The Second World War remains comparatively ubiquitous in popular culture, and there are undoubtedly good reasons for this. Primary among these, of course, is the fact that the Second World War, unlike its predecessor, achieved a clear and unconditional victory for the Allied powers. Almost as important is the notion that the later conflict has a more rewarding narrative arc, for which victory makes a satisfying conclusion. In its most basic form, the World War II narrative depicts the forces of democracy and freedom backed into a corner by the forces of pure evil, fighting back and emerging triumphant. The result of that triumph was the establishment of a new world order, a Pax Americana, that fulfilled Woodrow Wilson's World War I-era goal of making the world safe for democracy. As Albert Auster put it, World War II has become for Americans that mythic, Edenic moment when the entire nation bent itself to victory over evil and barbarism. The strength of the memory from World War II did not wane, even during the Cold War, the Forgotten War in Korea, and the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Thus, World War II has become the indispensable symbol of American virtue and triumph. It can be brought forward to exalt American arms and the American spirit whenever contemporary events require it. The success of that narrative is certainly no accident, and the persistence of World War II in the public consciousness has been especially evident on America's movie screens. Even a casual review of films made during the war years provides ample evidence of the concerted efforts of the Office of War Information and the American film industry to cement that narrative in the minds of the general populace as the war was still in progress. What is astonishing is the long reach of those efforts, which continued unabated for decades and remain potent nearly 80 years later. If the Second World War remains the benchmark of triumphant American military superiority, however, what of its predecessor? What is the dominant narrative of the Great War, and how did it develop? As George Creel recounts in How We Advertised America, the usefulness of film in shaping public opinion was certainly taken into account by the World War I era Committee on Public Information. At the very outset, it was obvious that the motion picture had to be placed on the same plane of importance as the written and spoken word. Movie stars such as Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin not only drew huge crowds at bond-selling rallies, but also contributed short films to the war effort, 100% American and The Bond, respectively. More important, both actors made feature films that used the war as narrative fodder, thus influencing the depiction of the war on screen. The First World War is the first American conflict that was fully processed on film, not only by documentarians who photographed events for posterity, but also by those working within the newly developed studio system to create fictional versions of the conflict. In the years following the armistice, those filmmakers came to include returning veterans with their own ideas about the depiction of the combat experience, ideas that frequently conflicted with established tropes for the portrayal of warfare on film. Those American filmmakers spent years modifying existing standards and working through a variety of narrative options before achieving a general consensus regarding a suitable approach to rendering the war on screen. The development of that consensus, the changes it wrought on the depiction of war on American screens, and the ultimate result of that long process form the central concerns of this book. Interpreting the impact and memory of a particular conflict is certainly not a new endeavor, and reams of literature have been produced assessing how individual generations deal with specific wars. Prior to the 20th century, the primary outlets for this activity involved the higher arts, literature, painting, sculpture, and so forth. Matthew Brady and Alexander Gardner added photography to the list of available tools for shaping historical impressions of a conflict during the Civil War, and Edward Muybridge, with his post-Civil War government contracts for photographing military installations and activities, especially those related to the Modoc War, provided an early link to the new art of the motion picture. The cultural products associated with these endeavors vary, but prior to the 20th century, they tended to approach the experience of war through a traditional narrative that emphasized the positive virtues of military service. A young man leaves his home and family to take part in a military conflict. While his experience may entail hardship and loss, in the end, he has matured into a better man, returning home to take his rightful place of authority with regard to romantic relationships, familial obligations, and social standing. This pattern can be seen throughout Western culture in works as old as Homer's Odyssey and continues with certain modifications until the mid-1920s. The years between 1915 and 1934 saw a remaking of this narrative in an attempt to encompass the enormity of the First World War. Though often discussed in terms of the literary endeavors of such authors as Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and John Dos Passos, or the rise of surrealism and expressionism in art, the move away from traditional approaches is no less important in the world of film. Frequently led by filmmakers with a direct experience of combat, popular film culture created a new and fully articulated vocabulary for addressing the impact of war on both individuals and society. Even more significantly, the rhetoric of these films argued strongly for an anti-war position, questioning every aspect of the wartime experience. In the larger literature studying the conflict, three key historical works have paid particular attention to the memory of the great war within and among the various nations that actively participated in the conflict. The most well-known of these is Paul Fussell's groundbreaking and much lauded The Great War and Modern Memory, which in many ways defines the terms of the discussion. Fussell, a veteran of the Second World War who was wounded in combat, argued that the First World War utterly transformed our views both of the experience of combat and of war itself. He was most interested in the way the dynamics and iconography of the Great War have proved crucial political, rhetorical, and artistic determinants on subsequent life. By examining the British literature of the Great War, he traces the change from Victorian and Georgian rhetoric glorifying combat to the irony-studded musings and post-war recollections of those who experienced life in the trenches. In this view, the war led to a significant break with the past. This break in turn generated a modern memory that completely redefined the cultural approach to life itself, a new modernist way of thinking that can be seen throughout the fabric of social and cultural life during and following the conflict. 15 years after the publication of Fussell's work, George Moss added to the discussion of the meaning of the Great War with his Fallen Soldiers, Reshaping the Memory of the World Wars. For Moss, the war was not the radical break suggested by Fussell, but part of a larger process of dealing with the aftermath of conflicts extending back to the Napoleonic Wars that manifests in various aspects of popular culture, cemetery design, and the construction of war monuments. Central to his argument is what he calls the myth of the war experience, which is a central concern of veterans searching for meaning in their military service, though Moss also suggests the importance of creating such a myth for political reasons. Those concerned with the image and continuing appeal of the nation worked at constructing a myth which would draw the sting from death in war and emphasize the meaningfulness of the fighting and sacrifice. The aim was to make an inherently unpalatable past acceptable, important not just for the purpose of consolation, but above all for the justification of the nation in whose name the war had been fought. In this formulation, the First World War is less a turning point on the road to modernity than another step in a larger process that justifies the traditional standards forming the basis of nationalist conceptions of patriotism, public service, and general order. For Jay Winter, in his Sites of Memory, Sites of Mourning, The Great War in European Cultural History, the memory of the Great War involved neither the radical break suggested by Fussell nor the more specialized remembrance implied by Moss. Rather, by examining the evidence of traditional expressions of grief seen in post-war art, literature, and war memorials, Winter demonstrates how communities sought continuity with the past by processing their impressions of the conflict through the application of existing tropes and forms. Winter argues that the war did not compel a radical break with tradition, but instead brought the search for an appropriate language of loss to the center of cultural and political life, in which older motifs took on new meanings and new forms. He tempers Fussell's more sweeping argument by suggesting that the strength of what may be termed traditional forms in social and cultural life, in art, poetry, and ritual, lay in their power to mediate bereavement. The cutting edge of modern memory, its multifaceted sense of dislocation, paradox, and the ironic, could express anger and despair, and did so in enduring ways. It was melancholic, but it could not heal. The question of what is changed by the conflagration of the Great War and what remains the same is an important one, and all of these writers contributed nuances to the discussion. There are two shared assumptions, however, that weaken the argument in each instance. First is the dominant Eurocentric view of the conflict. While it is fair to assert that Europe shouldered the brunt of the war's miseries, the participation of more than 4 million American men and women is not inconsiderable and had a measurable impact on U.S. cultural, literary, and political life. Though it is unfair to criticize these works for not investigating issues that are by definition outside the scope of their subject, these writers did not address the question of how the war shaped American sensibilities and modern memory. Bustle, in particular, is positively hostile to the notion of American literature comparing in any way to that of Great Britain, and is dismissive of any literary endeavors that emerge outside of England. This leads to the second shortcoming of these works, and the one that is the primary impetus of this study. None of these writers takes full account of the possibilities offered by cinema for understanding the attitudes and ideas of any nation regarding participation in the First World War. Not one to hedge his opinions, Bustle justifies his focus on English literature with the simple, spurious assertion that in 1914 there was virtually no cinema. In his chapter, The Process of Trivialization, Moss spends a few pages discussing film, but the depth of his general argument can be summarized in his assertion that the end results in all nations were much the same, the war presented as melodrama, romance, or adventure. Winter is the most attentive to film generally, writing that any account of the cultural codes through which mourning was expressed in the period of the Great War must explore this rich area of the history of popular culture. Films show well the imprint of the experience of mass death and mass bereavement on the cultural history of early 20th century Europe. Despite this assertion, Winter's chapter on film is extremely limited. He attempts to compare the imagery of traditional religious posters to the spiritualist approach to the war taken by Abel Gance in his two versions of J'accuse. While this line of thinking is not without merit, it hardly does justice to the role of film in processing the wartime experience. In his more recent Remembering War, The Great War Between Memory and History in the 20th Century, Winter is more circumspect about the use of film. One of the unfortunate features of the memory boom is the tendency of commentators to term any and every narrative of past events as constituents of national memory or collective memory, understood as the shared property of the citizenry of a state. Nowhere is this more evident than in the case of film. Time and again, the claim is made that the way cinema presents the past somehow passes in an unmediated manner into something termed memory. Winter is absolutely correct that broad assertions of memory should be carefully regulated, for reasons discussed in Chapter 1. The memory of one audience, those with first-hand knowledge of war, for example, may be entirely different from the memory evoked by that same film in their grandchildren. Despite increased pessimism, however, Winter's discussion of film in this regard is no more thorough. Remembering War focuses on a single film, Renoir's La Grande Illusion. The subject of the Great War in film has not, of course, been entirely neglected. A variety of studies have focused on the depiction of the war on film either directly or as an influential aspect of another topic. The former category includes such works as Craig Campbell's Real America and World War I, Peter C. Rollins and John E. O'Connor's Hollywood's World War I, Motion Picture Images, and Larry Ward's The Motion Picture Goes to War, the U.S. government film effort during World War I. The latter category includes important works such as Kevin Brownlow's The War, the West, and the Wilderness, Andrew Bergman's We're in the Money, Depression America and Its Films, Thomas Doherty's Pre-Code Hollywood, Sex, Immorality, and Insurrection in American Cinema, 1930-1934, and Leah Jacobs's The Decline of Sentiment, American Film in the 1920s. In addition, numerous studies have focused on the national cinematic output of the major combatant countries as it relates to their experience of the conflict. This list demonstrates a particular lacuna in the discussion that, despite the opportunity presented by the centennial of the conflict, has not been adequately addressed. Given the worldwide influence of the American film industry following the conclusion of the conflict, there has been a limited amount of specific, thorough analysis primarily focused on the ways in which World War I is presented on American screens. The work of several previous scholars has provided a solid footing for addressing this topic, each approaching the subject from a slightly different perspective. Michael Eisenberg supplied an early impetus for this volume with his War on Film, The American Cinema and World War I, 1914 to 1941, as well as his article on The Big Parade in Hollywood's World War I Motion Picture Images, helping to crystallize the difficulties of fixing the political stance of King Vidor's film. War on Film is less effective than might be hoped, however, especially given that when the book was published in 1981, Eisenberg was forced to defend the idea of looking at films through a serious academic lens. Regardless, he outlined the parameters of the discussion in a way that pointed to further research. In her Real Patriotism, The Movies and World War I, Leslie Midkiff DeBush offers the sort of research-oriented examination of World War I films that had previously been in short supply. DeBush's central interest is the connection between the government and the film industry during the war, a relationship she examines via case studies of individual films made from 1916 to 1918. Her final chapter, however, skips forward 9 years to focus on Wings, while briefly discussing the treatment of the war in other significant films of the 1920s. Andrew Kelly's Cinema and the Great War, though it also covers a variety of other national cinemas, thoughtfully considers many of the key American works that are discussed in this book, as does the most substantial work to emerge since the Centennial Observances, Michael Hammond's The Great War in Hollywood Memory, 1918 to 1939. All of these scholars provide solid foundations on which to build, but much remains to be said regarding the way in which film depicts the First World War. The conflict does cause a rupture in the way that American filmmakers discuss wartime service, though this break is not as extreme as Fussell suggests, especially given that it does not persist for an extended period. My approach is perhaps more in sympathy with Winter's arguments, suggesting that this process takes place through a gradual manipulation of traditional standards that eventually alters the established narrative in which war is a grand and useful experience that molds callow boys into mature men. Throughout the 1920s, American filmmakers increasingly began to incorporate facets of the experience of Great War veterans that countered and undermined the accepted narrative tropes. This process reached its peak during the pre-code era of the early 1930s, when the traditional narrative was briefly supplanted by an entirely new disillusionment narrative that questioned the premises of the traditional view of wartime service. Though I open my argument with an examination of films commemorating the Civil War, I do so primarily because those films established the primacy of a particular narrative model on screen. It is essential to define this baseline to fully understand the ways in which that model is manipulated and transformed as a vehicle for filmed portrayals of the Great War, especially given that the two filmmakers I discuss most thoroughly, D.W. Griffith and Thomas Ince, specifically provide a bridge from narratives of the Civil War to narratives of the later conflict. In addition, I intentionally focus on non-documentary films looking back on the conflict. I do not attempt to analyze the many fascinating documentary and non-documentary films made during the war, though a truly thorough history of those works would be welcomed. Further, this volume does not take an exhaustive approach, attempting to include every American film that focuses on or mentions the Great War. Nor does the book address the recent spate of depictions of the First World War on screen produced outside of the United States, a fact that speaks to the historical remembrance of the war in other combatant countries. These films include Sam Mendes's 1917 and Peter Jackson's They Shall Not Grow Old, both dedicated to the filmmaker's forebears who served in the war, François Ozon's France, a loose remake of Lubitsch's The Man I Killed, and a recent version of Journey's End, directed by Saul Dibb. Finally, I hesitate to refer to this as a traditional genre study. My qualms regarding the theoretical underpinnings of genre classification are reflected in essays by Andrew Tudor and Rick Altman that appear in Barry Keith Grant's Film Genre Reader 2. As Tudor's genre correctly suggests, despite the prevalence of generic terms such as war picture or adventure film, the use of the concept in academic studies is frequently problematic, since what is normally a thumbnail classification for everyday purposes is now being asked to carry rather more weight. Though Altman's A Semantic, Syntactic Approach to Film Genre usefully attempts to give the notion critical clarity by suggesting a practical approach to function, the result is frequently an expanding thicket of ever more problematic division into ever smaller categories. I am not convinced that these difficulties can ever be entirely eliminated, so while the films discussed here share a topic and certain thematic elements, I prefer to think of what follows as the tracing of an attitude and narrative approach toward the Great War rather than as the birth and death of some sort of subgenre. Chapter 1 reviews the properties of the traditional narrative, briefly examines its roots in literature, and traces its establishment as the standard filmic narrative. After discussing Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage as a literary antecedent, I trace the ways in which the traditional narrative was used by early filmmakers such as Griffith and Ince in their films commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Civil War. These filmmakers then adapted and applied that narrative as their attention turned to the Great War. The success of this traditional formula extended well beyond the cessation of hostilities throughout much of the following decade. Chapter 2 focuses on several major filmmakers who were also veterans and explores the ways in which they gradually transformed the traditional narrative. Their early efforts to come to grips with the experience of the war occurred in other media, a novel, a play, and a memoir, thereby allowing these creators the freedom to manipulate the established conventions in new ways. In films such as The Big Parade, Journey's End, and Young Eagles, Lawrence Stallings, James Whale, and William Wellman brought their own perspectives to bear on the discussion of combat and its effects. By comparing their efforts across media, we can see that unlike earlier films that discussed warfare through a 50-year-old lens, these men looked back after only a few years and found the traditional version in need of adjustment. Chapter 3 examines some of the first films to break away from the accepted narrative conventions. These films included comedies and animated works that took advantage of the possibilities for exaggeration and hyperbole, both visual and narrative, offered by the comic form. Some of the earliest of these films were also made by men with military experience who were able to convey otherwise unacceptable images and truths under the cover of the comic label. Images of violence, combat conditions, and the general life of servicemen that would not have passed muster in a drama could be conveyed through satire or slapstick, thus paving the way for a discussion of such subjects in more serious works. While most films examined in this study were produced in the context of the Hollywood studio system, Chapter 4 examines the narrative tendencies of films produced outside of that system for a minority community that had its own perspective on the meaning of military service. African Americans were drafted in large numbers during the war, but their service was fraught with difficulties born of racist attitudes toward their abilities. At the same time, that service was a source of tremendous pride within African American communities across the country. The output of the makers of independent race films functions on a continuum that reflects both of these facts as filmmakers try to maneuver through the contradictory attitudes of the black community toward wartime service. Chapter 5 discusses another group for whom the First World War was a watershed moment. Women served throughout the conflict in a variety of capacities, and a small but significant group of films directly addressed their experiences. The changing depiction of these women and their roles in wartime narratives directly parallels the modifications to traditional narrative patterns taking place across the spectrum of filmmaking and these unjustly neglected works are an important microcosm of my larger arguments. Chapter 6 discusses the fullest development of the narrative scheme that supplanted the traditional model. This disillusionment narrative directly contradicted the many...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?